Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jemetis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
Welcome, John.
Hello, Dave.
We're going to talk about the world of space flight and astronomy, your constellation of the month, and what to look for in the night sky next month, and events at local astronomy societies. But first of all, what is happening in space flight and astronomy then, John?
Okay, Dave. Well, I thought I'd start on a little sad note, if you don't mind. But a lady that has inspired a large number of people to develop an interest in astronomy, and I'm sure who will be known to several of your listeners, was Heather Cooper. And she passed away over a week ago, age 70. She really was one of the most prolific presenters of astronomy and writers, wrote lots of books. What was more of note, though, was she was the very first female astronomy presenter and writer. Perhaps best known for a couple of series on Channel 4, The Planets, that was in 1985, and The Stars, which she did in 1988. I think I've still got those on VHS somewhere. Let's dig them out. Thank goodness I didn't go Betamax. on radio, perhaps she's best known for a series on the BBC World Service, which she co-presented with her collaborative partner, Nigel Henbest, with whom she wrote many, many books. But that Seeing Stars lasted for many, many years. She's also noted for being the first lady president of the British Astronomical Association, so she broke the mould there. And then, later on, also became the first female president of the Society for Popular Astronomy. But of more academic note, she was the first female professor of astronomy at Gresham College. There have been two or three female professors at Gresham subsequently, but she broke the mould. She was the first. So a sad loss, and I'm sure there'll be notices about her in the various astronomical magazines. There already has been, of course, online and on radio. Now let's move on to something a bit more local. I like to be able to mention MSSL, Mallard Space Science Laboratory, just down the road here at Holmbury St Mary. Now, they're part of University College London, and they do an awful lot of work on space missions, solar system exploration. They have got a couple of experiments and did an awful lot of the design on an important new space probe that has just been launched on the 20th February from Cape Canaveral. And this is called Solar Orbiter. So it's a European Space Agency probe, but as I say, a good considerable part of the work done at MSSL. There is a NASA involvement as well. They provided the rocket, an Atlas V, and there'll be great collaboration between NASA and European Space Agency on this because it will complement the work done by NASA's Parker solar probe, which is already on station observing the sun. The solar orbiter won't be going as close as Parker solar probe does. There are two quite different missions. Solar orbiter is going to be doing a lot of measurement of the solar wind, but also taking photographs, which Parker can't do. Parker has to be completely protected by a heat shield. Solar orbiter also has a heat shield because it's got to withstand temperatures of around 500 degrees. It'll be close enough to be uncomfortably hot. But it'll have ports in that shield through which lenses poke through for some imaging work. It's important because what it's going to be able to do is look down onto the top and underneath the sun. It's going to be able to view the poles. which other spacecraft up there observing the sun, like Solar Dynamic Observatory and the STEREO pair, can't do. So to do this, it's going to use a very complicated series of planetary flybys, getting gravity assist. So the first one of these will be Venus. So it's heading towards the sun now, meeting Venus in December this year, and then changing its trajectory. It'll go nearish the sun, but then back round almost to Earth again, to get a gravity assist from Earth, and then Venus again, then Earth again, and Venus again, and so on. It's actually going to take just over 3 years to get into its final position. But they do this to make the use of the free use of gravity from the planets, saves putting an awful lot of fuel on board. And yes, you can get to the sun relatively quickly, but the idea is to study it, so you need to slow down, and that would take an awful lot of fuel. So this means that you sacrifice the fuel, extend the mission, and use the free trajectory assists from gravity. It will be a highly elliptical orbit by the time it's finished, well inside the orbit of Mercury, but still coming out to the sun, to the Earth rather, from the sun. So it'll close in on the sun once every 6 months, do its study, and then return, cool down, and be sending all of its data. Interestingly, the heat shield, which is mostly made of course, artificial materials, but actually includes compounds that have been generated by ground down animal bones to get the particular form of charcoal. To act as a heat shield. Interesting that we've got this sort of Neolithic approach, but built into a very modern spaceship.
High-tech animal bones.
Absolutely.
Strange, yeah. Isn't it?
It really is, most odd, but it works. It works, so don't try and invent anything new if it works. Okay, whilst I'm talking about the sun, Dave, I'll move on to something that's related. We don't just do observing of the sun from space. We get better details there, but there's an awful lot of astronomy that can be done and science that can be done from Earth. And there's a brand new massive telescope. It's called the Daniel K. Inouye telescope, and it's got a mirror that is 4 meters across. So that's a massive reflecting telescope, and that sits on top of Mount Haleakala, if that's how you pronounce it, on Hawaii. And that has just been commissioned, and it has undergone what we call first light. That's the time when you first show the telescope to the sky, its first light. And these first light images are just absolutely incredible. Now, we know that the surface of the sun is a mass of plasma cells rising and falling as they heat down below, come to the surface, cool down as they radiate their heat up into space, and then sink again, and are constantly being replenished. Now, these solar cells are about the size of France, and I've got a picture on the supporting slides to show our listeners what these cells look like. And I've also got a link on the slides to a video that they'd really enjoy seeing, because that video is what shows something that's never been seen before. This telescope can get to details as small as 18 miles across on the sun's surface. And these are, our listeners will see them on the video as bright lights between the dark lanes that separate these cells that rise and fall. It's thought that these are caused by magnetic storms. And it's wondered whether this is perhaps the mechanism that channels the heat from the sun up into the corona. Because it's always been a bit of a mystery. The surface of the sun, hot, 5,000, 6,000 degrees, you know, hotter than we could take for sure, but it's nowhere near as hot as the corona, which is the outer atmosphere, which we measure in millions of degrees. So how do we get this difference between a surface of 6,000 and the atmosphere of millions? And it's thought that perhaps these magnetic storms are channeling heat, you know, from the very, very hot layer below the surface of the sun through the surface and up into the corona. Now, of course, you'll remember, I'm sure, from school days, doing things with mirrors and magnifying glasses and the sun and so on. And you know that focusing the sun's light, you know, can cause you to set blotting paper on fire and things like that. Sure, we've all done it. So clearly, if you've got a 4-metre telescope, that's a big mirror, and you're focusing the sun's light using that, you've got to keep the instruments that are receiving that light cool. So it uses 7 miles of piping through all of the instruments and the telescope array. And they have to produce the equivalent of a swimming pool of ice each and every day to keep it cool. So as one of the advantages of being in space, you can radiate some of that heat away. But it's a stunning new solar telescope, only built, you know, to study the sun. Do listeners, please do go and have a look at the video. You'll see the URL on the slides. Now, talking about stars, which is what our sun is, perhaps the best known star at the moment is Betelgeuse. We talked about this last month, Dave, all of the excitable media thinking, well, we know it's going to go pop in a supernova.
It's supposed to be next week, wasn't it?
Well, some people were saying tomorrow. But, you know, we know it's going to go bang sometime in the next million years, perhaps within the next 100,000. But it's not going to happen anytime soon. Because, as I reported last month, Betelgeuse had sunk to its lowest ever level. It's been seen to go down to about magnitude 1.5, and that happened about 70 years ago. In October, it suddenly started dimming faster than people expected and reached magnitude 1.62, which is the lowest ever recorded. But astronomers were saying, no, we think this is just something to do with one of the three known sets of pulsing, if you like, associated with Betelgeuse. You know, we do have stars that are, we call, variable. They will brighten, they will dim. And this particular star, a giant star, is known to have three cycles. Yes, that's the word. And one of them happened to be about 430 days long. So on the 21st of February, some astronomers were saying, keep watching, it should start brightening after the 21st of February. And indeed, it did. So that's proven that theory right, that this fainting, as it's called, was just a particularly deep instance of this cycle. Get out there, folks. Have a look at Betelgeuse, which is the top left-hand star, bright red star in the corner of Orion, and you'll see that it's slowly starting to brighten. Keep watching it over, you know, the next month or so. We'll see how long it takes to come up to its full brightness. So we can call off the doom mongers. Mind you, it would have been tremendously exciting if it had gone supernova. It would have been quite a sight. However, one thing to mention about Betelgeuse, we've talked about imaging the sun. Normally we can't image stars because they're so far away. Now, Betelgeuse is relatively close. Was it 500 million light years? Yeah,
just around the corner, mate.
Absolutely, 500 light years. So And because it's so large, you know, if it were in the centre of our solar system, its radius would take it out to the orbit of Jupiter or thereabouts. So it's a massive, massive star. So we can actually image that one as a sphere. Now, the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope, the VLT, which is in Chile, the Atacama Desert, one of its instruments called Sphere has just imaged that star again and compared it to images taken just about a year ago. And they really are quite different. It can be seen that only one of the two hemispheres of Betelgeuse is dim. The other one is still bright. But why? Nobody knows. And also the image shows, and again this is included in the slides, is slightly lopsided. So again, all a bit of a mystery, and there's still so much to learn about stars of this nature. Indeed, all stars. Okay, let's... whilst I'm still on with Orion and Betelgeuse, just a quick reminder. Today, if you're listening to the programme on the first day of broadcast, Friday the 28th, it's the last day of doing the star count for the CPRE, which started last Friday the 21st. The weather hasn't been too kind to us. I've only been able to do the star count just the once. I'll try again tonight. Remember, what you have to do is count the stars inside the square, the rectangle that is subtended by the four corner stars, the two shoulders and the two knees of Orion, but excluding those four. So see how many you can find. I got up to nine. Okay. And submit your results through the CPRE website. As we're sticking with Orion, I just thought I'd also mention a very recent study that's just been announced. Two very large radio telescopes have teamed up to study some protostars being formed within the Orion Nebula, or more correctly, the extension of the nebula, which is called the Orion Molecular Cloud. It's long known that this is a place where stars are being formed as the clouds of hydrogen gas collapse under gravity. Eventually, it'll heat up, the little clumps of gas will heat up, and nuclear fusion will start, and a star will be born. But visual telescopes can't see through the density of the clouds of gas and dust within this Orion Molecular Cloud, but radio telescopes can. And so these two telescopes, the VLA, the Very Large Array, and ALMA, the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, can pierce through these clouds of gas and dust. Dust and gas, and they're working in different frequencies, but working together. So they're producing models of both the outer structure of the disk where these stars are forming from, and the inner structure. So this hasn't been seen before in such detail. We're beginning to learn even more about how stars form by doing this kind of study. So again, there's some pictures of that are in the set of slides. Anyway, let's bring it down a little bit closer to home, shall we, Dave? And back to the International Space Station. And one of the astronauts that I've mentioned a couple of times, who's been on there for about 11 months, is Christina Koch. Now, she has just come back from the longest voyage ever by a female astronaut. Her mission was 328 days. And so she's parachuted back under the in the Soyuz spacecraft with two colleagues, the Italian and a Russian. down into the Russian the Kazakh plains. So she's conducted 6 spacewalks in that time, including, of course, the first all-female spacewalk. People like Yuri Gagarin went up for 1 orbit, John Glenn, the first American, 3 orbits, and so we gradually increased the number of orbits that men were doing around the Earth. The number of orbits she did while she was up there was 5,248, and she did 139 million miles. So
not exactly a beginner.
Not exactly a beginner. In fact, she is now, the most experienced female astronaut, obviously. I think the 7th most experienced American astronaut. Now, one of the things she was asked about, what she was looking forward to when she...
Pizza.
That too, when she got back down to Earth. She lives on
her dog.
Her dog, indeed. But she lives on the beach. In South Texas,
swimming,
and apparently she's an expert surfer, and she couldn't wait to get back into the water. Oh. And there's a great picture of included of her on the slides of her standing on the beach, just enjoying it, savoring it. Oh, I'm back. It was a wonderful picture. I think you'll agree. So with Christina and her 2 colleagues now back on Earth, that just leaves 3 astronauts up on the International Space Station, rather than the usual 6. And that's 2 Americans and a Russian. Now, they will be joined on April the 19th, I think, is the date when 2 Russians and an American are due to launch on a Soyuz. There's been a bit of an unexpected turn of events there. The Russians have just announced that the 2 they were going to send in April have been scrubbed, and they're replacing them with a different couple of astronauts, citing medical reasons. They've not explained any further. The backup crew, there's always a backup that's ready to go, will in fact be promoted to the prime crew. That's as far as the Russians are concerned. The American, who was due to go, still will. So those 3 will launch in April. There'll be a handover period of about a week, and then the 2 Americans and the 1 Russian who are on there now will return to Earth, just leaving those 3 again. So that's a little bit of a downturn in terms of number of people permanently on board. Usually it's a crew of 6. Now they're going to stay on their own, just the 3 of them, until the first launch of the Crew Dragon by SpaceX, with a couple of NASA astronauts on board, just 2. Now, initially, the 2 astronauts on the Crew Dragon were only going to stay for a week or thereabouts, but NASA are now planning to extend their mission to maybe a couple of months. So the space station crew will then go up to 5. But after that, then hopefully both the Boeing... Starliner, the Boeing Starliner capsule, and the Crew Dragon will be starting regular services, and of course Americans won't be reliant upon the Russian Soyuz to get there. Okay, now one last thing about the International Space Station, chance to fly the Union Jack here. We've got for the first time, a completely British instrument or piece of equipment on board the ISS. Now, last week, a Northrop Grumman Cygnus resupply vessel docked at the International Space Station. Unlike the SpaceX Dragon that docks. This one flies alongside and gets grabbed by the remote arm and is brought in alongside so that it can be unloaded. Now, on board this Cygnus supply vessel was an antenna, a really, really high-speed communications antenna that is going to be mounted via a spacewalk on the outside of the Columbus module. And that's to provide extremely fast uplink and downlink data transfers between the International Space Station and Earth. Now, this was built by a company called MDA Space and Robotics Limited. Now, they're based at on the Harwell site. And so that's the very first completely British component on the ISS. You know, Britain has contributed to projects before, but, you know, as part of Europe. But this is the first time it's a completely UK venture. Okay, now... we've mentioned SpaceX, and of course that makes you think of commercial, and Boeing makes you think of the commercial side of space. So I ought to mention Virgin Galactic. Now, of course, they, a bit like SpaceX, have milestones that never quite seem to be achieved, but they are very confident now about starting to launch their passengers into suborbital space hops using their Virgin spaceship Unity, which is carried up to about 50,000 feet under the carrier plane called White Knight 2. Now, these two, the Unity and the White Knight 2, have relocated in preparation for starting these commercial flights from Mojave Desert, which is where Virgin's development facility is. They've moved to Spaceport America, which is in
New Mexico,
that's right. And that's a very futuristic modern building that can actually house five of these spaceships and two carriers simultaneously. And two more of the suborbital spaceships are under construction as we speak. So they closed the ticket sales some while ago when they reached 600. So that's 600 people that have each paid something of the order of, or will be paying, $250,000 dollars for a seat on these. So that must, if they have, well, six spacecraft, that would be six people... I can't do the sums
six
here, Dave.
Six people at a time.
Six people at a time, 100 flights.
100 flights.
Yeah, indeed, to get through that lot. So that's why they closed down the ticket sales. However, because they've got more of these craft in production and are starting to fly later this year, they've announced a new ticketing scheme only this week. So it's, first of all, a qualification scheme for people to start to register for tickets. And the second tranche will go on sale, and the mechanism for that will be announced shortly. And apparently the qualification scheme is called One Small Step, and the actual registration procedure is called One Giant Leap. That's a good bit of promotion work.
Very
there.
Good.
And it's understood that the first commercial flights, you know, will definitely be later this year. However, I mean, pinch of salt may be needed, because don't forget that Richard Branson said he would be in space himself on one of these on the date of the Apollo 50th anniversary, which was last summer. So, but the very fact that they've relocated to Spaceport America does look a very, very positive sign.
$250,000 is a lot of money, but then it's a unique experience, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, don't forget that Virgin's competitor in this area is Blue Origin's, Jeff Bezos's company. That also will be suborbital, but won't be via a space plane.
No, it's a drone.
A rocket with a little capsule, again taking five or six people up, a little bit higher than does Virgin Galactic, and then landing them under parachute in the desert. They haven't announced a date for that. But again, that's expected to be possibly this year, but certainly next year if not. But the ultimate space tourism bit, SpaceX have just announced that they've come to arrangement with a company called Space Adventures. And what they're going to be doing is to fly private citizens on the Crew Dragon, but not with NASA astronauts or SpaceX astronauts, but just private citizens on their own, just four of them at a time, in the Crew Dragon on an orbital mission. Now, before I go on to describe that, Space Adventures was the company that arranged the private flights to the International Space Station that took place between 2001 and 2009. And those were priced at about $20 million. That was using a Soyuz before the prices started to go up on the Soyuz. So I think about eight different people went up to the International Space Station through that route. The last one was going to be Sarah Brightman, but she had to cancel for some kind of family.
Oh, the singer.
Yeah, indeed. She'd already paid, but she had to cancel for some family reasons and hasn't taken up the seat again. Now, the Crew Dragon won't be visiting the International Space Station, but it will go into an orbit that's much higher than the ISS. And the trip is meant to last probably 4 or 5 days. But it's thought that the Crew Dragon, is perfectly fine with four astronauts on board for, that amount of time. Normally, it's just used as a taxi to the International Space Station from a few hours to get there, then sit there on the space station until it's time to bring them back again. A few hours to descend. But it can operate completely autonomously for 4 or 5 days with these guys on board. And they won't need an astronaut taking care of them. They're going to have to be very friendly, though, because you've not got separate toilets or bedrooms or anything of that sort. You just sit there in the seats.
Seriously, 4 or 5 days in space in
yeah.
a tiny little capsule.
Yeah. Well, it's big enough to actually take seven, so they have got room, but in terms of supplies that they'll need for food and so on, as I say, you've got to be fairly friendly. But don't forget, astronauts were up in space in tiny little Gemini craft, two at a time, and they'd spend, best part of 10 days, if not more. It must have got pretty smelly in there, I'd have thought. They'd have been glad for their very first shower, I'm sure, when they got back down. These people are going to have to put up with those kind of conditions and pay something of the order of $50 million for the privilege. But
he'll have to build himself a hotel in space, though. I mean, you can't just send people up for 4 days.
Well, maybe that's next. With Elon Musk, who knows?
Unless he's already built one and not told us. Or the Chinese built it on the dark side
of
the moon.
Well, don't forget,
that's what the Chinese were doing on the dark side of the moon. They're building him a hotel.
Ah, righty-ho.
Got it.
And doing it faster than anybody else could,
yeah,
I'm sure.
10 days. Yeah, no problem.
Upside, of course, of not needing an astronaut on board and the spacecraft flying autonomously is that training will be minimal. People would have to spend months and months and months training to go up to the International Space Station for those flights back in the last decade. But for this, it'll just be a month or two of training for zero G and so on. And they reckon that the first of these flights will be in the last quarter of next year, 2021. Now, as we're talking about SpaceX, that brings us on to Starlink. They have had, since we last spoke, two launches by SpaceX, each taking 60 more Starlink broad broadband satellites up to the space station. And one of those was on the 29th and of January, and the other one was on the 17th of February. Now, the as you know, with the Falcon X, Falcon 9 rocket, rather, that lands vertically either back on land or on the drone ship. So for the January mission, the first stage landed okay on the drone ship, but unfortunately they missed the drone ship in the launch only 10 or so days ago. And that's because this particular batch of Starlink satellites were in a different orbit. So the rocket had to work harder to get them there, had less time to turn round and reorient itself to point back at the drone ship, and was coming in a bit faster. But it only missed by about 5 or 6 yards. So it landed in the ocean right alongside. So I'm sure they still they had it hoiked out of the water very, very quickly. But the fact that it's been in salt water means that it's a different kind of refurbishment that it would have to go through if indeed it can be reused again. However, now these two lots of 60 have brought the number of Starlink satellites to 300 they've now got up there. By the way, I've just noticed on the slides that there's a typo there. I've called them Starlink satellites. It is, of course, Starlink. I'm interested in birds as well, but we don't have starlings in space. A murmuration thereof. So they've now got a competitor up there. Now, this sounds a bit multinational. There's a company called OneWeb, and that's a British company. They're London-based. But they had already put up one or two experimental satellites via launches from Soyuz. But on the 7th of February, from Kazakhstan, using a Soyuz rocket, OneWeb launched 34 broadband satellites are all in one batch, and they plan 10 more this year. This is a bit of a different approach to SpaceX with the Starlink ones. That's because OneWeb satellites are in a much, much higher orbit. Starlink are at about 550 kilometres, and OneWeb satellites are at 1,200 kilometres. So OneWeb satellites can see further. They can see over the horizon. They need fewer of them. And one thing that they, I believe, have is direct links between the various OneWeb satellites, which SpaceX currently doesn't have. It's all reliant on ground station. So each one, of course, say, yeah, we're the best, as you would expect. But this is going to become an increasing problem. Remember that SpaceX have said they're launching 60 every fortnight for the rest of this year. So that really is going to start swamping some astronomical observations from Earth by professional observatories, radio telescopes. So the International Astronomical Union is stepping up its efforts in seeing what can be done about this. It's going to be quite a battle, I think. You know, the world needs better broadband, but it doesn't need its science research being compromised. And to add to the mix, Jeff Bezos is also planning to enter the market later this year with a constellation of satellites called Kuiper, doing the same kind of job. It's a very, very competitive environment.
It'll be amazing when it's done, because you'll be able to get, you know, high-speed broadband from any point on the entire Earth's surface, which is getting ridiculous, but...
Yeah, I mean, from that point of it, it's got to be a good thing. It's got to bring on countries that don't have the capabilities for development because of not having broadband that we do. So from the world perspective, it's a good thing. From the scientific perspective, less so. Okay, now... One thing too, I've talked about in the past, Dave, of course, has been InSight. Our probe on Mars, well, the NASA probe on Mars. Not a rover, but one with two very important science instruments on it. One, a probe, which was to measure the heat flow in the Martian crust by digging down to about 5 meters below the surface. And the other important instrument was the seismometer. So I want to talk about both of those, because you'll remember, and our listeners will remember, that I've mentioned how this probe has failed. It's got an inbuilt hammer that digs it into the ground. Now, all of that worked fine in tests, and indeed it was the approach that we would have used on Beagle 2. And that was thought to be, you know, perfectly acceptable way of digging under the surface. But it seems that where it's landed, the regolith, as the name we give to the Martian soil, seems to be harder, crustier than we were expecting. And whatever they've been doing, the probe has managed to dig down. I think the furthest it got was about 30 centimetres, and then it's just bounced, popped out of the hole again. You know, as the inbuilt hammer hammers downward, it just recoils and pops out. So they're more or less out of options. One that they don't think to be particularly tenable, they're still considering, is to use the scoop on the end of the lander's arm to pile up a big sandcastle, if you like, around the probe. And hope that and pat it all down and hope that will give it enough friction to start working again. But that one has largely been discounted. What they're going to spend the whole of March doing is to simulate pressing with the arm onto the top of the probe. So to give it a little bit more oomph when they start it hammering again. But the big, big risk with this is that the arm pressing on the top of the probe will damage the cable that carries all of the control and all of the data back from the probe to the lander, because that is exactly where it's positioned. And it hasn't been built as with hard points expecting that kind of pressure. It's relatively delicate. So they're going to spend the whole month simulating this without actually touching the probe, so that they can do it as gently as possible while still bringing enough force to bear for it to hopefully start to get a grip and continue its mission. So that's the probe, the latest on the probe. But it is a year since it's landed, and we've just had a paper produced that talks about the other instrument, the seismometer. And the seismometer has returned information about Mars quakes. And there's been a lot. There's been about 450 in the year that it's recorded. But don't worry, it's not a violent planet. It's just that it is seismically active. There is still heat deep below the surface, but that heat is cooling. As things cool, they contract. So the planet shifts a little bit. The ground shifts. Previously old magma caves underneath the surface, perhaps, are collapsing. Or the ground is shifting slightly. So these have only reached what we remember. We use the Richter scale, don't we, for earthquakes. So these have only reached 4. At the most, which is hardly noticeable. It's likened to Britain, in fact. Britain gets about the same number of earthquakes a year, but we're totally unaware of them. And they say if you were sitting in the middle, the epicentre of a Richter scale 4 earthquake, you'd notice that your teacups and saucers are rattling a little bit in the plates.
It's a big heavy truck going past you in the road, isn't it?
That's the sort of level.
So yeah. This is Martian trucks going past the lander.
Could be it's those aliens again, Dave. But what it does mean is that eventual astronauts on the surface needn't worry about cataclysmic earthquakes. There don't seem to be any. And so they can take that into account when they're designing the structures that they would be building. Interestingly, this seismometer, which is a joint British-French instrument, although taken there by NASA, is so sensitive that they can't use it during the day, because during the day there is heating, and so there is a bit of a wind, and so the wind is enough to move the seismometer so much that it would mask any of the Mars quakes. So they have to wait till night, there's no wind, it's all nice and quiet, then they could start measuring. It's that sensitive an instrument. Okay, the next topic is our New Horizons probe. You'll remember that zoomed past Pluto a couple of years ago, and then was retargeted. They found something that wasn't even discovered when it was launched, and that was called Ultima Thule. Now, you'll remember that because that name has been used by some right-wing organisations, they've renamed it Arrokoth, and New Horizons flew past it on the 1st of January last year, 2019. So they've been studying the data about Arrokoth that has been sent back in that year since. And what they've learnt from that data is that we have to slightly rethink our ideas about how the solar system formed. When you look at planets like Mercury and Mars, and the Earth, of course, there are craters on the surface. Mercury is heavily cratered. The Moon is heavily cratered. Most of the Jupiter and Saturn moons are heavily cratered. So it's been thought that planets and planetesimals, protoplanets, if you like, have been formed by big major collisions. Now, there's obviously been a lot of that going on, but it's not the only way in which things coalesce together into planets. But New Horizons, when it looked at Arrokoth or Ultima Thule, showed that it was just gradual accretion. Bodies out in the Kuiper Belt have been slowly moving around each other, slowly getting close to each other, slowly grazing each other. And as they've grazed, so the surfaces have melted, flash frozen, and they've fused together. And so it's this slow accretion through gentle collision that's now thought to be how protoplanets have started, as gravity starts to exert itself over these small, small bodies. So that was the theory that was started to be proposed when people got a look to see what Arrokoth looked like, and the data is definitely bearing that out. So quite an interesting turn of events there. Just shows how we're continually learning, and old theories sometimes have to be discarded as we learn more and more about our solar system and our galaxy beyond. Now, talking about a mission that was way, way out there, you'll remember Voyager left the solar system, or according to some definitions of where the edge of the solar system is. Now, 30 years ago, Voyager 1, approaching the edge of the of the solar system, the engineers running it had to take a decision about how can we keep this going? How can we conserve power? And so one of the instruments that was switched off over 30 years ago to conserve power was its camera. And so it was proposed before the camera was switched off, it should turn round, point towards the solar inner solar system, and take a family portrait of all of the planets that make up our solar system, from Neptune, Uranus, Saturn, all the way in to Mercury. And this it duly did. So 30 minutes before it switched off forever, it took a photograph of Earth. And, you know, that's it's always been called the pale blue dot image, because that's what was returned. It was just slightly less than a pixel across. But scientists at NASA have just used modern processing techniques on that old original data as a way of paying tribute to Voyager and also to Carl Sagan, who was involved. And so that image has been released, and I've included that in the set of slides. But what I've also included is the words Carl Sagan used, which I just think are just absolutely magical. He said, "Look again at that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you have ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam." Those are absolutely magical words, Dave. And so those are the ones that I'll end my little foray into the solar system for this month.
He was an amazing character, wasn't he, Carl Sagan?
He really, really was. Incredibly inspirational.
Thank you, John, for the update.
Stars Over Surrey, Constellation of the Month.
So what is your constellation for the month then, John?
Oh, this month, Dave, you're not a twin by chance, are you?
Nope.
Nope, okay, me neither. It's Gemini, the twins. It's an easy-to-find constellation, not too far away from Orion, which we looked at last month, and heading over towards Leo, which we'll be talking about in a couple of months' time. Two bright stars there, Castor and Pollux, you know, the two brothers, one of whom was mortal, one of whom was a demigod, but put up in the sky to keep them together. Some interesting clusters to be found, and multiple stars in that constellation.
The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey.
Now, John, what will our listeners be able to see in the night sky over the next month?
Okay, well, the night sky is dominated in the west by the planet Venus, and that remains good throughout the month. But in terms of constellations, still the one that perhaps is the most dominant in the night sky is Orion, which we've talked about earlier. And then Gemini, not far from that, our constellation of the month. Then the faint constellation of Cancer, and that leads on to Leo. And again, another very recognisable constellation. If you look almost overhead, then we've got the Great Bear, Ursa Major, or the Plough, that small asterism, easily recognised, that forms part of the Plough. Other constellations still around. Towards the north, you'll have Cassiopeia. Pia and Perseus, good constellations to find, rich star fields in. Run your binoculars around those, and you'll have an enjoyable time. If we move on now to the sun and the moon, the first quarter of the moon is on the 2nd of the month. Full moon is on the 9th, and some people will call it a super moon because it's a nice and big one. It occurs when at perigee. And then the last quarter is on the 16th. The darkest period for observing is when we have a new moon, and that's on the 24th. Of course, the sun is starting to rise earlier as the month draws on. At nearly 7 o'clock is when it rises at the start, but by about 22 at the end. And of course, don't forget that includes a change in our British summertime, which starts during this month. In terms of the planets, we've got Mercury as a morning object, Venus as a bright evening object, and Mars as another morning object in the southeast. The southeast is the best place to look, in fact, for planets apart from Venus, because we've also got Jupiter as a morning object in the southeast, and Saturn also in the southeast. In fact, we've got Saturn, Mars and Jupiter all quite close together, as I'll be describing in individual detail a little bit later. Uranus is still an evening object, so that can be seen in the west, but it's probably the last month for catching Uranus. But don't forget, it's not really visible with the naked eye. You've got to use a good star map or an app on your phone or your laptop to show you whereabouts it is, and you should be able to find it with binoculars. A greenish, bluish, small dot. Neptune isn't visible this month at all. So to help you find various objects, I like to use the moon as your guide, because everybody can find the moon. So on the 2nd, the first quarter moon, the crescent, half moon sort of shape, is very close to the Hyades cluster in Taurus. This is a V-shaped cluster with Aldebaran marking the top of the V, top left-hand side of the V, and that is the face of the bull, if you like, in Taurus. Then the moon will become move from half moon to a gibbous, sort of three-quarters shaped moon on the 6th, and that will be in a messier object that you might not have found your way to until now. M44, the beehive cluster. In Latin, it's Praesepe. But that's a nice cluster of stars, about third magnitude stars. But they look really, really nice through a pair of binoculars. So find the moon and just look a little bit below the moon, and you'll see the rest of the beehive cluster. You can use Venus as a way of helping you to find Uranus on the 8th, because Venus will be only 2 degrees above and to the right of Uranus. So find Venus, you can't miss it, on the 8th. Look 2 degrees below and to the left, and there you'll find the planet Uranus. So it won't be twinkling like the stars will, because the stars will just be points of light. Uranus, a very, very small but discernible disk. Then moving forward to the 19th, the moon will be quite close to the planet Saturn. But it'll be a crescent moon, and this will be a morning on the 19th, and it'll be about 4 degrees away from Saturn. But then a week later on the 26th, Saturn, Mars and Jupiter form quite a nice flat triangle low in the southeast before dawn. So get up about an hour before sunrise, get out there, make sure you've got a low horizon, no trees or houses in the way, and get your binoculars out and you'll find the three planets relatively close together. And I've got a picture in the set of slides to show you what it will look like. And then there's another picture to show 2 days later when the Moon and the Venus and the Pleiades, another messier object, M45, make a nice grouping in the evening sky in the west. And that's it for phenomena for the month, apart from remind you that on the 29th, the clocks go forward for British summertime. So before I talk about societies, I'd like to remind you about a local planetarium at Winston Churchill School in Woking. Relatively small, so make sure that you book up tickets in advance, and you can do this online. So just Google Winston Churchill School Planetarium. But on the 13th of March, they've got a two-hour program called Destination Mars. That's from 7 until 9 o'clock, and that will cost you £8. And a fortnight later, on the 27th of March, a one-hour program for £5, and that's called Stellar Safari. So do give them a try. That's a very good little local planetarium. I shall include that regularly. Now, local society meetings. Our biggest society locally is Guildford Astronomical Society, and on Thursday the 5th of March, it'll be have a local focus, because down in Guildford, as a spin-off from Surrey University's Space Centre, we have SSTL, Surrey Satellite Technology Limited, and Spyridon Gramenos from the company will be talking about the work of SSTL. So that's at Lecture Theatre L, the University of Surrey, 5th of March at 7:30. Another good society nearby is Farnham Astronomical Society, who meet at Aldershot Cricket Club, Tuesday the 10th of March, at 7:45. It's Dr. Lillian Hobbs. Now, she was an IT by profession, and I've heard her speak several times, but she's a passionate astronomer and very, very knowledgeable indeed. And she's talking about astronomy using tablets and smartphones. So that should be quite a good talk. There's so much that you can download that helps you to do astronomy. Further away, but still in Surrey, we've got Croydon, Royal Russell School, Coombe Lane, Croydon. Two meetings a month they have. The first one is Friday the 6th at 7:45, and that's Conrad Mallin Smith, one of their own members, talking about spectroscopic binary stars. And then I think it's another of their members, Peter Bull, on the 20th, with a talk called A Window Through the Universe. At Cheam, just about still in Surrey, Yule Astronomical Society meet at Nonsuch High School for Girls, and somebody who I heard talk last week, in fact, elsewhere, David Fishwick, who used to be a science teacher at Nonsuch School, but one of the founding members of Yule Astronomical Society, is talking about the planet Mercury, Mercury's long afternoon, Friday the 13th at 7:45. Walden Astronomy Group, who meet in the pub without formal lecture sessions, but their next stargazing evening will be on either Friday the 13th or Saturday the 14th of March, 8 till late. Check their website, waltonastrogroup.co.uk, as to see where and when, which night will it be, and obviously that's weather dependent. And the University of Surrey, I think it's their last astronomical evening this year. I will check on that. But it's Wednesday the 18th of March at 7 o'clock. And in Lecture Theatre E at the University, there'll be a talk for about three quarters of an hour, followed by, if clear, stargazing, or if not, a talk about what we should be able to see in the night sky. As always, it's a free event, but you do need to book in advance. Now, so at this point, I would normally talk about the sky at night, astronomy on TV, but they're taking a breather this month. There isn't one, but they will be back in April. But I would, suggest to listeners that they check ahead in Radio Times or equivalent to see, you know, what Horizons programmes come on or what Brian Cox series might be showing. Unfortunately, the BBC don't announce more than a week or two ahead, so I can't tell you, other than the Sky at Night programmes, that I can look a little bit further ahead for those, but not the others. But there's bound to be something on. Okay, Dave, that's it. I think we're done.
Thank you, Don, for the fascinating insights. This show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast. The podcast will also have more items in that we couldn't fit into the broadcast. The next edition of Stars Over Surrey will be Friday, 27th of March.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jamatis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.